You got questions, and we're going to try to get you some answers.
How dangerous is coronavirus compared to other sicknesses like Ebola and the common cold?
Is this airborne or not?
Can we be reinfected?
What makes this strain something that we should all panic over?
I'm Duarte Geraldino, in for Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for St. Patrick's Day, we'll get you some sound advice on the coronavirus pandemic. We're taking your questions at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
It's kind of like coronaviruses and New England Patriots, and the specific virus that causes this is Tom Brady.
Also on the pod, we take a look at food supply in the wake of coronavirus.
This is causing very dramatic short-run disruptions in the supply chain, and that's why you see these shortages of food, which should be resolved in a matter of days, because the supply chains solve these problems relatively easy in the short run.
And later, how the cancellation of South by Southwest is affecting breakout musicians who were set to perform there. All that and more. Let's start with the latest on Corona.
I've spoken actually with my son. He says, how bad is this? It's bad. It's bad. But we're going to be hopefully a best case, not a worst case. And that's what we're working for.
The White House issued new nationwide guidelines to help slow the spread of COVID-19 in the U.S. They're advising us to avoid gathering in groups of more than 10 people. The administration also wants us to limit eating and drinking in bars, restaurants, and other public places. And President Trump is also encouraging parents, keep your children home from school.
If everyone makes this change or these critical changes and sacrifices now, we will rally together as one nation and we will defeat the virus and we're going to have a big celebration all together.
The president also, for the first time, acknowledged the possibility that the pandemic could lead to a recession. He also said we could still be dealing with COVID-19 for months.
People are talking about July, August, something like that.
So far, more than 4,500 people in the U.S. have confirmed infections. But because of limited testing, experts agree the real number may be much higher. There's still a lot of confusion surrounding this unprecedented outbreak. And here to help answer some of your questions are two people who have been closely following this pandemic. Helen Branswell is the senior writer for infectious diseases for Stat News. Helen, thanks for coming on the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Bill Hanage is an associate professor of epidemiology at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. Bill, so glad to be here with you.
Hi, Duarte. Thanks for having me.
There's so much confusion over COVID-19, and we got this call from California.
This is Dee Dee from San Francisco. Is COVID-19 and coronavirus the same thing, or is there a difference between the two? They seem to be used interchangeably.
So, Bill?
So, there is a little bit of sort of semantics here. COVID-19 is a disease. Coronavirus is the family of viruses to which it belongs. You can think of it, and, you know, don't hate me for saying this, but it's kind of like coronaviruses and New England Patriots, and the specific virus that causes this is Tom Brady. And then COVID-19 would be the touchdowns that he throws.
All righty, guys, here's another one.
Hi, this is Andrea calling from Minneapolis, Minnesota. My question is what we know about how long the virus can live on different surfaces. I work in a school, and I'm wondering if we're not going to be there for 2 weeks, is it necessary to still disinfect everything?
You know, I think some of that information is still coming into view. It seems to be fairly hardy on surfaces, but, you know, one thing to keep in mind is that just because something can live on a surface if you test it in a lab doesn't necessarily mean that that's the way you're going to contract it. This is a disease that attacks the respiratory tract, and mostly people probably get it from encountering respiratory droplets that are coughed or sneezed out of the people who are infected. Those things can land on surfaces and can probably exist there for a while, sometimes days.
Wait a minute, you said days? So if someone who is infected, say for example, is having a cocktail at a bar and you go there, you could become infected if you touch that surface at a bar?
I think it's all about the reduction of risk. If you look at WHO and what they found out during the mission to Wuhan, the great majority of transmission occurs by the droplet route. Droplets are, you know, the little kind of bubbles of fluid that come out when we cough, to an extent when we talk, but they don't go very far and they like drop about 6 feet away. You've got to distinguish between a theoretical possibility and an actually significant contributor to the epidemiology. So I think that what the folks listening to this at home should think about is that, you know, it's all about reducing your risk. You know, I've had questions about, well, we've got long supply chains. Well, if I order something from Amazon, how do I know it's not been handled by somebody with COVID-19? And the answer is, well, you don't. But the chances of you being infected by something which came from there are so much lower than they would be than, say, if you went to a big crowded bar for a St. Patrick's Day celebration, for instance.
We had a few people ask how this compares to outbreaks that we've seen in the past. Here are two of our callers.
Hi, this is Sean in Oceanside. I want to know, how dangerous is coronavirus compared to other sicknesses like Ebola and the common cold?
Hi, my name's Lorraine in Davie. Coronavirus has been around for years and years. Is this strain of coronavirus more dangerous? What makes this strain something that we should all panic over? How is it different?
Helen, you've been covering the infectious disease beat for years now. What's the difference between this pandemic and some of the other outbreaks that we've had?
There are a number of coronaviruses that are circulating year in and year out, but they are not this one. This one is a new one, and it causes more severe disease at this time than the ones your caller was talking about. There are four human coronaviruses that cause effectively the common cold. This one is more severe. So that's why it's being taken much more seriously. How does this compare? Well, you know, Ebola is a very serious disease, but it only circulates in a belt in Africa. And although occasionally somebody with Ebola leaves Africa and goes to other places, Ebola isn't a threat worldwide. This one clearly is moving around the world. And while the fatality rate is much lower than Ebola, it's something that effectively all of us are potentially in, you know, line to catch. And so we have to be careful.
The interesting thing about Ebola, like Helen was saying, is that Ebola is controllable, even though it causes extremely severe disease and has a very high mortality rate, because it's really easy to identify people who have Ebola. And they are only infectious at the point when they have symptoms. So that means that you can contain it. The difference between Ebola and the current pandemic is that this virus is, for a start, nobody's immune to it. There is no immunity, unlike the other coronaviruses that we see every year. That means that everybody who becomes exposed is likely to become infected. The second thing about it, which is not like Ebola, is that it's getting very clear that some transmission occurs around about the time that people realize they're infected. So in other words, people who are not yet showing signs of infection, people who would not yet realize they were infected, can transmit it. And that makes it much, much, much harder to put a lid on.
Helen, there's been so much controversy over the state of testing for COVID-19 here in the U.S. A few of our callers asked about that.
Hi, my name is Jody. I'm calling from Alexandria, Virginia. I would like to know how we take care of ourselves if we have the symptoms, but we haven't been eligible for testing.
Hi, I'm Marilyn. I'm calling from Eugene, Oregon. And I wanted to know, how soon after you've been exposed can you get an accurate test, presuming that there is testing available, which we are very short on in this country?
The statistics say that effectively 80% of people who get this will only have really mild influenza-like symptoms, in which case they should just stay home. The people who go on to have more severe disease will know it, because they're going to start to have trouble breathing, and that's when they need to contact their medical options and arrange to go in to be tested, and they would be tested at that point. For the majority of us, there aren't tests right now, and the majority of us don't need to be tested right now. What you need to be doing is paying attention to your health and make sure that if you're not feeling well, don't be out and about. In fact, we should all be sort of reducing the number of contacts we have with other people at this point.
So on the notion of testing, Bill, and I'd like you to chime in on this. We do know that there may have been quite a few people who have gotten the virus, recovered. If they were tested, would we know that they ever had the virus? Is there any residual antibodies in your body left that says, okay, you once had coronavirus, COVID-19?
It depends on the test you're doing. The kind of test that we've been talking about so far is a test to see whether you're infected, and it works by detecting the presence of the virus's genetic material. You can do another test, which is the kind that you're talking about, which is able to detect whether or not somebody has been exposed. Those tests are going to be incredibly informative, but they're coming online, and I haven't seen any large quantity of data from them. There was one that was used in Singapore in order to link two unknown transmission chains. They were found to be linked together by a guy who'd been infected in a church and had never been aware that he was infected, but he had led to two completely distinct transmission chains. So these are really important tests, these serological tests, but they're not online in large numbers at the moment. I want to echo what Helen was saying, because tests are scarce. And where you want to be using the tests right now is for people who are in hospital, who doctors want to be able to tell whether or not they are infected with COVID. Because if somebody is infected, then they have to take very different precautions in order to protect other patients and themselves. So essentially, if you're well enough to be walking around and thinking that you should get tested, you shouldn't get tested. You should stay at home and drink fluids and, you know, tell your friends to be wary and perhaps isolate themselves as well.
So on that note, you know, if you're well enough to get tested, then you're saying you shouldn't get tested if you can essentially recover on your own. You know, there is sort of a public health issue with that. Some people want confirmation of infection in order for you to get services. If you don't actually take the test, do you think there'll be a situation where some of the benefits may not flow?
You know, I'm not really sure at this point. Some of this stuff is so new that how it's going to work will be seen over time. The last thing the system needs right now is the worried well flocking to healthcare providers to be tested for something that they probably don't have. I mean, if you're not really ill, you don't want to be in a situation right now where you're potentially encountering people who are really ill. You know, if you need healthcare, you should get it. If you're just worried, you should monitor your health and stay home. You know, this is not the time to go to an emergency room unless you need to be in an emergency room.
Bill, members of our community also want a little bit more clarity about how COVID-19 is actually transmitted. Listen to this call.
Hi, my name is Julie. I'm from Omaha. Is this airborne or not? I've heard both. I've seen both, and I'm just not sure which to believe.
Bill?
So there are different routes of transmission. As I said previously, the majority of this is droplet and fomite. The airborne route, which I think your caller is referring to, is what we would usually call an aerosol. And those are, you know, that's much more sort of scary, because it's the sort of thing where somebody can be infected while walking down a corridor that somebody was infected with walked down previously. That's the way that measles is so explosively transmissible. We do not think that this is a major route of transmission in most cases. The exception is that aerosols may be produced by some medical procedures, like intubation, and that's one of the reasons why we need to be so careful that the patients who are being treated in hospitals are identified quickly and treated with appropriate care.
Bill Hanage is an associate professor of epidemiology at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. Helen Branswell is senior writer for infectious diseases for Stat News. Thank you both for answering our listener questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll be answering more of your questions in the coming days and weeks. Leave us a voicemail at 1-877-869-8253. We'll try to answer them on the show, and you can find all of our coverage of COVID-19 at thetakeaway.org/coronavirus. The coronavirus has people across the country swarming stores, stocking up on food, hand sanitizer, toilet paper, and other hunkered down supplies. And as we all face restricted movement or quarantines, supermarkets are running out of staples like bread and canned goods in many places. And all of those eerie photos of empty food shelves, they don't tell the whole story. Miguel Gomez can help explain how all this rapid bulk purchasing could affect our food supply in the short and long term. He's the Robert Tobin Professor of Applied Economics and Management at Cornell University. Miguel, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Should we be worried about food shortages during this pandemic?
I don't think we should be worried, but we should be attentive to what's going to happen in the next few months with the supply chain. In the short run, we have seen shortages of food for certain categories in the grocery stores, because just people are buying more than usual, in some cases 50% more, 40% more in every product category. So this is a temporary jump in demand that is going to go back to normal very soon. Also, we see shortages in the stores because people are eating less in restaurants and buying more at supermarkets because they want to eat more at home. As our governments are indicating us that we should eat less out and more at home to be more in our house and not with places where there are too many people. So this is causing very dramatic short-run disruptions in the supply chain. And that's why you see these shortages of food in the supermarkets, which should be resolved in a matter of days because the supply chains solve these problems relatively easy in the short run.
So, Miguel, because people aren't going to restaurants, do you expect them to buy 50% more each time they go to supermarkets for the foreseeable future? Or is this just a one-time thing?
No, I don't think that's the case. I think people are going to buy relatively more in the supermarkets just because they are buying less from restaurants. And but it's not going to be that increase that we have seen in the past 2 weeks. So I think over time, you know, in the next month or so, we are going to see more stable demand in supermarkets. So we will see, of course, some here and there, some stock outs of certain product categories. But overall, when we think about all the product categories, we should be confident that there is going to be enough food to feed our families in the next, in the next weeks.
So what about the small stores compared to these large supermarkets? Will either of them have a difference in their supply methods?
That's a very good question, because bringing the food to smaller independent stores is typically more expensive than bringing food to big supermarkets. So it may be possible that for larger supermarkets, it may be easier for them to replenish their shelves. And perhaps for smaller stores, it will be more difficult because they rely more on wholesalers and distributors than large supermarkets, which own their own distribution centers. So that's a good point. Smaller stores may have a more difficult time replenishing the stores and take a little bit more of time in doing so.
There's growing evidence of international trade disruptions. How might those disruptions change the food supply in the U.S.? Are we likely not to see certain items that we're used to eating here in the U.S.?
That is correct. Global supply chains tend to be longer and involve more businesses. And the possibility of disruptions in the global supply chains is higher. Let me give you an example. For example, we import as a country a wide variety of fruits and vegetables, you know, avocados, tropical fruits, certain types of vegetables. And it may be more difficult in the future if there are supply chain disruptions that affect international trade or cause congestions in our ports due to the current situation. So that is true. It is important. We may become, interestingly, more local in our food consumption as consumers. We will consume more local products.
So do you think that's one of the future trends that might be influenced by the coronavirus? The future of food in America might actually be more local because of what's happening today with this virus?
I think so. I think that's a possibility, at least in the short run. I believe that the food supply chains and the food system is becoming globally integrated, but I think at least in the short run, we may see a change, a reduction in trade.
And finally, what can we do to tweak our own buying patterns to help the larger market to ensure that we always have food to eat?
I believe it is important to do not panic, and to trust the food system that we are going to have enough food to eat. So So if you buy too much, you may, at the end of the day, may be wasting food because you are not going to be able to use it also. So to stock up, but not as we have seen in the past few weeks. The second aspect is to, we can change our diets to, I think it is important at this moment to move from what we call fancy foods to more basic foods that can be stored for a long time. You know, we need to think about lentils, beans, rice, and commodities that you can storage and are nutritious. So we may need to alter our consumption patterns depending on what's available in the stores. Some products are going to be more easily found than others.
So you're telling us to say goodbye to fancy foods?
No, not at all. But to be ready to maybe not find some of the products that you may want in the store.
Thank you so much. Miguel Gomez is the Robert Tobin Professor of Applied Economics and Management at Cornell University. Miguel, so good to have you on the show.
Thank you, Dart.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
You're listening to The Takeaway, and I'm Duarte Giraldino. Live music venues across the country shut their doors because of the coronavirus. For artists and people who work on those shows, it's a major loss of revenue.
Enough with the Cadillacs and the Hampton Estates.
And one of the first major music festivals to be canceled was South by Southwest in Austin, Texas. Roughly 2,000 artists were supposed to perform there this week. It's a massive festival, and for many artists, it's also massively important. Many up-and-coming musicians were looking forward to having a breakout moment at South By. The cancellation of the festival is devastating for them. This year, the list of emerging artists who were supposed to perform is a really interesting one. So we decided to give you a taste of what you're missing. I want you to meet two people who are in the know about what might have been the breakout acts at South By Southwest. Eduardo Cepeda is the music editor for Remezcla.com. Hey, Eduardo.
Hi, how you doing?
And we also have Deidre Gott. She's a live music producer for KUTX. Hey, Deidre.
Hello.
So, Deidre, you're speaking with us from Austin, Texas. What does the cancellation of South by Southwest mean for people out there in Austin?
Obviously, our economy really thrives and depends on South by Southwest, from bartenders to music venues to restaurants to Lyft drivers. I mean, this affects our economy. A lot of businesses depend on this to keep their doors open for the rest of the year. So it's a huge blow for sure.
But given what's going on with the coronavirus, were you still shocked when they canceled it?
Like at first, you know, just like what, 2 weeks ago, it was like, oh, there's no way they're going to cancel South By. It's just too big of a beast. You can't stop this from going. There's no way. They've never canceled it in the, you know, 34, however many years it's been. But then as the days go by and more facts come out and everything, it just like snowballed. And it was a big shock. Obviously, it was necessary, as we know now.
Eduardo, in years past, South by Southwest has meant a lot for up-and-coming Latino and Latin American musicians, right? How are they being affected?
Well, you know, a lot, and this goes for every kind of artist, a lot of artists kind of plan their Southwest tours around South By. So, you know, they plan to spend about a week or so in Austin, and they program dates around that. So a lot of these smaller artists, that's what they make their living off doing, is performing in front of audiences. So the cancellation of South By has meant for a lot of artists have had to, you know, basically cancel their tours. And now it's, of course, it's spreading now. And so they're canceling tours in general. But, you know, South By was kind of the first moment where we started seeing this happening.
What about the Latin artist in particular? Is this a particular blow for some groups that were hoping to make a big splash to expose their music to more diverse audiences?
Yeah, definitely. We actually had our own unofficial South by Showcase at planned this year. And one of the artists, for example, that we were really, really excited about, and a lot of people were excited about seeing this year, his name is Natanael Cano. And he's kind of part of this up-and-coming movement of corrido music coming out of California, which is geared more towards, you know, the younger generation. It's like a reimagination of the corridos like your tios were listening to, made for people who grew up listening to hip-hop or grew up just immersed in American culture, but still wanted a connection to the music that they grew up listening to. And so this was one of the artists who was going to perform at our event, and we were hopefully going to get him in front of a lot of like a more mainstream audience. Levantando el vuelo voy, toda mi gente está alerta para cualquier punta. Soy el layer pa que sepan, por aquí no existe la traición.
You know, his music, I can see hints of sort of older school music of that genre, but there's also something different. How would you describe that difference?
Well, there's various names being thrown around to describe this music. Some have been calling it trap corrido. Others have been calling it corrido urbano. He personally refers to it as corrido tumbados. you know, and so it's just kind of this new like melding of, you know, hip-hop influences with corrido music they grew up listening to. If you listen to a lot of his music, he's rapping. And in fact, recently, a few months ago, Bad Bunny, a very, very known artist, found one of his songs and asked to be on a remix of it. So there's kind of this like joining of these worlds of urbano music with corrido now starting to happen. And the South By event was going to be a huge deal for him because this was going to be the first time he was going to perform in front of an audience outside of his already built-in sort of, you know, California West Coast audience.
It's such a big blow because we're sort of missing out on his huge debut. Deidre, what ends up happening to artists who wanted to make a big splash at South by Southwest? They're in Austin, they've traveled, and now what do they do? You know, they have no place to perform.
You know, honestly, a lot of the bands aren't coming. Like, the first wave of like announcements of South by getting canceled, a lot of even mine, it's like that first week after South by got canceled, we were all kind of scrounging around trying to figure out how can we still place bands that are playing, who are still coming to town. Like the venues were all banding together to, you know, still do showcases with the bands coming from out of town, as well as, you know, our vibrant Austin music scene. But by the end of the week, everybody changed their tune and things were canceled. So there's not really anything happening. We're kind of all social distancing in Austin.
What a blow financially to some of these artists who are living gig to gig. Eduardo, you know, COVID-19 is forcing the cancellation of concerts across the country. In this streaming era, is it financially viable to live stream performances for musicians? Can they make money that way?
I mean, not through actual streaming numbers. You have to remember, even the artists who are, we're talking about artists who are doing maybe 10, 20, 30 million streams a year, they're not making a lot of money off of that. That's a check that may cover 1 month's rent. So what I've seen happening now is a lot of artists are banding together to do live streams and are asking for donations through that. Now, if enough people log on to something like that and you know, pay into the PayPal or whatever Venmo that they're using, that could be a viable way, but it's ultimately not sustainable for a long period of time.
Eduardo, another musician that was going to perform at Remezcla Showcase was Nino Agustin. Now, he's a Panamanian reggaeton artist, and he's got a song that's pretty hot right now. So what stands out to you about Nino Agustin?
Well, for us, Nino's an artist who we've been following for quite a while now. When we talk about the genre urbano music, as it's been referred to, which includes reggaeton, it includes, you know, Latin trap music, urbano's beginnings really, really trace back to Panama in the 70s, when a lot of Jamaican artists were sending instrumentals of their dancehall music to their cousins in Panama. And kind of that's where the beginnings of reggaeton began. And you see now in the music industry, especially in this huge urbano industry, not a lot of black artists are being highlighted. And Nino Augustin is, you know, he's a Black Panamanian from Panama. He now lives in Atlanta, so he's picked up this kind of Atlanta Southern trap sound that he's been kind of incorporating a little bit into his music. And so he's really doing an interesting take on kind of the original Panamanian reggaeton and bringing it into the, you know, into 2020.
So Deidre, I know you were excited to see the Austin band Star Parks at this year's festival. And I believe the title of that song is Oh Boredom, Schmaltz City, USA?
Correct, yes. Star Parks is from Austin. They're KUTX's Artist of the Month. And they're an example of one of those bands that, you know, is a huge blow. They are a 9-piece band now at this point. They have like a horn section and a vibraphone. And they're one of those bands, like a lot of budding bands, that this South by cancellation kind of keeps them at the bottom of the hill trying to get their music out to a larger audience because they can't tour with a 9-piece band. They tour with a 4-piece. So South By was a chance to be able to have that full sound that you hear on the record to a larger audience.
There was another band, really fantastic music that you mentioned, and the band Heartbones. I'm the kind of girl who wants to listen to what you say. If I'm gonna stay, so that reminds me a little bit of the 80s. One of their biggest inspirations was the soundtrack to the movie Dirty Dancing. Is that right?
That is correct. It's a collaboration between Sean Tillman, who is known as Harmar's superstar, and Sabrina Ellis, the front person of Sweet Spirit and A Giant Dog. So they became friends while touring with each other. And yeah, they got their inspiration by listening to the duets on Dirty Dancing, and actually went on the road and chose to introduce Heartbones, as they are, singing the songs of Dirty Dancing, along with a few of their new originals. So this South By, they would have just released their debut album. I mean, it is out now. It's called Hot Dish. And their tour, which was already in progress, was going to roll through Austin and then keep going until April 20th, but it's now postponed indefinitely.
Ugh, so sad. Eduardo, I know that one of the ones that you were hoping to hear is Divino Niño. It's a group based in Chicago.
Yeah, they're great. They're, you know, they're making, I guess, a sort of psychedelic pop sound. But what I think is really interesting about them is, you know, if just about anybody listens to them, they're going to hear some kind of Beatles influence and stuff like that. But for Latinos who grew up with their parents listening to, you know, 70s pop while they're cleaning the house on Saturday, you're going to hear some of those influences too. So it's kind of really just music created by Latinos for Latinos who just understand all the different influences that come from our, you know, different upbringings.
Oh, I want to hear this. So right, Eduardo, I'm getting flashbacks of a different time and era.
Right.
Deidre, the musician Brittany Denise Parks performs under the stage name Sudan Archives. This is her song, Confessions. There is a place that I call home, but it's not where I am welcome. And if I saw
Sudan Archives, I was really excited to see her perform because I've never seen her live before. She's an experimental violinist, and she kind of mixes these elements of R&B and African beats and electronic music and creates these beautiful, catchy lines that just get stuck in my head. She's usually a one-woman show because she uses loop pedals and plucking and bowing on the violin, for this really cool sound, but this tour that she was just doing was going to be her first non-solo tour. She was going to be joined by a pianist, and I was really excited to get to finally see her live, and that's not happening now.
Eduardo, your final pick is Angelica Garcia. Tell us about her.
Angelica Garcia actually recently performed. We have an emerging music series called Nuevo Noise, and including the editorial we do around it, we do these live shows at Elsewhere in Brooklyn. She performed there with Loyal Lobos for us. And Angelica Garcia is really interesting because she's this Chicana singer from originally from Los Angeles, and she's taking the same way kind of Divino Niño is doing it, taking her influences and mixing them with what she grew up around in the United States. And she really got a boost a few months ago when Barack Obama put out his list of songs of the year. Her song Jicama was actually included in that, and that kind of brought her out to a bigger audience.
So let's hear her song. Deidre Gott is a live music producer for KUTX, and Eduardo Cepeda is the music editor for Remezcla.com. Deidre, Eduardo, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
And that's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening. If you ever want to share your insights with us, call and leave us a message at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can also follow me on Twitter at Duarte Geraldino. This is The Takeaway. Stay safe and healthy out there. See you tomorrow.